Hello. Today we're going to do a listener Q&A. It's been a little overdue and there's a lot of questions to get to. We're going to talk about what's coming next. We're going to talk about what you're worried about right now, processing messes that are going on, and a lot more. So let's take our first listener question.
Hi, Travis. Thanks for all that you do. I appreciate the information that you provide us here. So my question is, I currently have 99 qualifying payments for PSLF and would complete my 120 payments in March of 2026. That is if I'm able to buy back the months I lost on the save forbearance. I submitted an application to leave save plan and move to the IBR in November of 2024. I used my 2023 tax return, which I knew would be significantly lower than my 2024 tax return would be. And for my 2024 tax return, I'm filing an extension with the hope that my application to move to the IBR will be processed before the October deadline to file extended taxes, and that they will use my 2023 taxes to calculate my loan payment. If I am asked to recertify in February of 2026, which it appears they have said, which I could hypothetically use my 2024 taxes. So my question would be, will the buyback amount be calculated based on my 2024 taxes? If my payments up until that point had been my 2023 taxes, because they gave us that extension to recertify, so I would technically be paying on my 2023 taxes, or will they calculate it based on my 2024 taxes? And then my second question, when I submitted my application to move from SAVE to IBR, I checked consent to the IRS sharing with the Department of Education. Is this going to be a problem when the extended tax filing deadline is up in October? Will this cause them to automatically use my latest taxes when the extended recertification is up in February of 2026? I am worried that if I revoke consent, though, it will cause more IBR processing time delays because I'm still waiting for them to process even moving me to the IBR. And then finally, and this one you don't have to answer, it's just a thought. In the recent statements by the Department of Education, they keep referring to themselves as, quote, education, and not, quote, Department of Education. Is this a way for them to insinuate that it's no longer a department? Those are my questions. Hopefully you'll have a chance to answer them.
A lot of great questions here. So in theory, PSLF buyback is supposed to be the lower of the payment on IBR that you had before or after the forbearance happened. So in theory, they're supposed to go give you the lower of the two payments pre or post forbearance. In terms of processing time, like hopefully it's done by October. We only have, maybe about, five more months until the extension deadline for taxes. If we think about that, I don't think this person can do anything in particular to speed it up. I don't think that revoking consent will really help or hurt, honestly. I think that, yes, it's absolutely a risk with having given consent that they will pull from the IRS automatically. And so I think that what I would probably do is maybe submit another IBR application. If the first one's not done, it doesn't tend to hurt to just go ahead and submit another one online and just hope that it gets filed and done by mid-October. That's pretty much the only thing that I think you could potentially try to do. Like I said, with the revoking consent, I think that that's not going to help you to revoke consent. If anything, they might be like, huh? What? Why? I mean, I think that the processing thing is such a mess right now, I don't think it would hurt you either way, to be honest. I think they wouldn't even notice, but probably better to not change anything at this point. I'd probably would just throw in another IBR application because why not? In terms of, referring to themselves as education instead of Department of Education, yeah, that's probably, a naming thing, right? That they're probably trying to do intentionally to try to emphasize that they're not a department anymore. But a federal judge recently came out and said that that's legal, that they have to be a department, that they have to reinstate all of the fired federal employees from Department of Education. That will certainly be appealed, though, to a more friendly jurisdiction. We'll just have to keep monitoring that. But there's a reason that out of the PSLF buyback and the IDR application so far, a recent court required disclosure found that only 3% of them approximately in total had been processed, which means that they would finally get through that backlog in 2 years from now, theoretically. So I have more thoughts about that. I think that they're dragging their feet intentionally to try to delay all the processing until they pass their Big Beautiful Bill Act. Once they do that, they'll be forced to move everybody onto the new plans anyway, so there won't be any point to processing any of those applications. I think that's their attitude. We'll see. Let's take another question.
Hey, Travis, I have a question that I think a lot of people out there are wondering. Ever since the IDR account adjustment was launched in January, we all saw our trackers on the FSA website. So the good news is that a lot of us, myself included, see that we have only a handful of payments left until forgiveness. So that's fantastic. In my case, I have 6 left. The bad news is I don't think many people were really expecting to get that close. No one really knew how we were going to shake out in terms of the payment counts. And now what we're looking at is our forgiveness coming up on the tax bomb here at the end of 2025. So in my case, I will make my final payment in October. However, I don't have any expectation between my servicer and the gutted FSA office that my forgiveness will be processed in any sort of expedient amount of time. I think it probably will take months, and it would be gut-wrenching for them to process it in January or February right after the tax bomb. I mean, it would be a killer. And because I really wasn't prepared for it to happen this soon, I don't have the money saved up, and I'm sure a lot of people out there listening in a similar situation also are not prepared to pay the huge amount of tax they're going to have to pay. So my question is, if we can complete our payments within this calendar year, so again, using my example of October or really any other month, would it count as being forgiven this year, even if it's not processed until a later date? Could it be backdated to the point of the final payment? I've been looking everywhere online and just have not been able to find any information on this topic. And if you happen to have any insight, it would be enormously helpful. Thanks so much, Travis. Appreciate you.
Wow, this is a real interesting one too. If you get it forgiven, I believe the as of date would be the principal as of date in the NSLDS. So the principal as of date would be when they determine you have made your 120th payment, they would backdate it to whatever final date that you should have made your final payment on. But with this Department of Ed, we cannot really know either way what they will do. Like, there's no way to control this, I think, unfortunately. So here's some positive thoughts about it. If it happens in 2025, you're partying because you don't have to pay any taxes on the forgiven balance, right? This person's a non-PSLF borrower, probably obviously calling in. If I'm thinking about what happens if this occurs in 2026, there would be no choice but to do some tax planning around this. You would probably look at whatever the tax bill that comes out with this Big Beautiful Bill Act. Again, that's the name of the bill. Don't shoot the messenger. That's literally what they're calling it. That's the formal name of the bill. So the Big Beautiful Bill Act, if they pass it and they do all these changes to the tax code, there might be like opportunities for bonus depreciation, for example. Maybe, for example, if you are a business owner, perhaps you could, and you know, obviously if you're not doing PSLF, you're probably in the private sector. So could you become a business owner or practice owner, for example, and purchase a car with car payments and see if you could depreciate through, like a Section 179A deduction against your tax bomb amount, for example? Or, you know, if there is bonus depreciation for real estate, have you always been dreaming of a vacation home and maybe you don't have a lot of assets, but you can't afford it with your income? Maybe you do the Airbnb vacation home bonus depreciation thing if that survives in the latest version of the bill. So I think that in 2026, you would either get it forgiven tax-free or you would have a lot of tax planning opportunities. Either way, I think that you would be able to survive if you're really intentional about planning for it. But that is pretty stressful. And, you know, sometimes with stressful things, the only thing you can do is just try to do your best to mentally and financially prepare and hope for the best, but preparing for the worst. Let's take another look. Question.
Hi, Travis. How are you doing? I want to thank you for what you do. Love to follow your videos. I have a unique question here based on what came out the other day out of the House, the GOP bill they're trying to put forward. I'm a current MBA student. I have a year remaining. I'm set to finish in May of 2026. I was planning to go directly into law school the following fall. Now, I'm concerned because of them taking away the Grad Plus loans to help pay for that. I know there's a grandfathered-in statute that says if you're receiving current Plus loans, you can continue to receive it for your program. How would that affect me in a situation where I'm taking grad plus loans for my MBA program and then going to transition into a law school program the following fall after that June 30th, 2026 date that was listed in that bill? Would I still be grandfathered in to get grad plus loans because I received them before and am still going to school? Or are they going to say, oh, no, you're starting a new program, you're not eligible to receive them? Thank you for your help with this.
So this would be super scary because the answer would be if you are not enrolled in the program as of July 1st, 2026, you are completely ineligible to borrow possibly anything. We have to double check up the bill text and we have to double check what the Senate version is going to be. But they said, you know, the aggregate limit period is 150K and including, you know, prior programs that you attended. So like there's a chance you wouldn't be able to qualify for any federal student loans. I have to triple check that in terms of what would be the impact if you already had a bunch of grad plus loans. But I know for sure that, you know, if you were eligible to borrow the 150 maximum, you would only be eligible for that and no more. And so if you're trying to go to a law school program that's, you know, $40,000 a year times three times living, you know, that's 120K plus living expenses of, you know, 30. So that's 90 plus, you know, 120. You know, you'd have to borrow a significant amount of private loans to be able to attend in that case. Suddenly, all of these graduate programs that people are going to want to attend are going to become completely inaccessible. And you're going to have the choice of going to like a very cheap state program or like a night school, law school or something like that, because those will be the only options unless you're very wealthy or unless you decide to go to a school that gives you, you know, a very large scholarship discount or something like that based off of, you know, having a good LSAT score or something like that. Yeah, this is really difficult for people who are going to be students in programs after July 2026. If this passes, it's going to cause a massive number of programs to close. Let's listen to another question.
Hello, my name's Jake. I recently graduated from pharmacy school in May of 2024 and then started a PGY1 residency in June of last year. My repayment was supposed to start in November, so I applied in October for an IDR plan. Of course, applied for the SAVE plan. It seemed like a good idea, but it is currently in review. And as we know, this may no longer be a thing. So my question is, can I apply for another IDR plan while this is in review? And I did not consolidate my loans. Should this be something that I do as well going forward? Thanks.
So for this person, I mean, like consolidation at this point probably doesn't help them any. It probably didn't hurt you any, but it probably didn't help you any either. So you probably would just keep the loans as is, just straight up direct loans. Now, in some ways, this might help people if they need to pay off their loans. It really depends on how much Jake's got in pharmacy school loans. Because if he's got, you know, $150,000, let's say he's making $120,000 at some point and working in the private sector as a pharmacist, well, you probably will want to pay that loan back and pay it back through refinancing at some point. And there would probably be some opportunities planning-wise if you don't consolidate to, you know, refinance only the grad plus loans that have a high rate of interest, tackle those first, right? Maybe you're refinancing all your 7% loans and leaving the 5 and 6% alone, keeping them federal just for some of those forbearance protections. Maybe you're taking down those refinance loans first and then paying off the rest. Can you apply for a different IBR plan? Yes, you can apply for IBR and you can, you know, apply on studentaid.gov/IDR. And the question is, you know, do you qualify for new IBR or old IBR? If you qualify for new IBR, that might be helpful only for the next few months, depending on how this GOP bill goes. But if this person's got more than a 2-to-1 debt-to-income ratio from pharmacy school, a lot of people do have a much higher debt-to-income ratio than 2-to-1 for pharmacy school, especially if you go to one of the private ones, then you would go for forgiveness either way, probably. And the question would be, how optimized can you make it? But yeah, I would probably decide, do you need to pay off your loans or do you need to go for forgiveness? And then you need to figure that out first. And then if you need to pay off your loans, you want to write out the 0% subsidies on SAVE. If you need to go for forgiveness, you need to get credit on forgiveness and get onto an IBR plan that qualifies for that. You know, that's kind of what a consult service does. If anybody knows they need that, you know, studentloanplanner.com/book. Let's take another question.
Hello, Travis. I just wanted to thank you for the podcast. I've been following it for probably about a year now. I am working towards PSLF, and I had a question about when to apply. Whenever I am on studentaid.gov, I see my progress towards my PSLF qualifying payments, And it appears that about half of the loans that I see on the list have a different payment account. They have about 7 more than my other half. And I think that's due to the fact I applied for the PSLF, limited PSLF waiver, and it counted some of my payments towards the loans that I had during my undergraduate. And then whenever I went to graduate school, I got a new set of loans. And those loans have about 7 less qualifying payments. So I was just wondering, when should I apply for PSLF? Or do I apply for PSLF twice for both sets of loans? The other confusing part of this is, I guess I thought my loans were consolidated, but just looking closer at it may not be consolidated because they all show up as separate loans. And some of them are unsubsidized, some of them are subsidized, some of them are listed and they say consolidation loan. So it's a little all over the place, but main question being, when do I apply? November 2025, where I would be set to get forgiveness for these 114 qualifying payments for the undergraduate loans, or in June 2026, where it looks like I might be due for forgiveness for the graduate loans. Hopefully I can get some advice here. Thank you so much.
So if you have two different PSLF dates, yeah, you're going to have to apply with two separate batches. In a perfect world, you maybe would consolidate to get it all done at once, because you can consolidate them again and theoretically get a weighted average. But at this point, I would not do that because it's probably too dangerous, because they could just wipe out that executive order overnight and then suddenly take back that rule that exists that says PSLF, after the PSLF IDR waivers, consolidations are supposed to be weighted average. That could be gone at a moment's notice. So I would keep it as is. And if you need to apply twice, that's probably what you're going to need to do. Kind of a mess, but you know, that's probably the right way to go about it. And yeah, if you have several loans listed, then it looks like they didn't consolidate everything for some reason. All right, let's do another question.
Hi there. My name is Morgan. I am recording a message with a couple of questions about the new law that was proposed. The first question is, as it relates to taxability of forgiveness at the end of the term, I'm curious whether or not that's addressed and whether any forgiven amount would be continued to be considered taxable income. Second question that I have is with respect to people that have maybe really high balances compared to income, where the payments based off of income are not covering the full amount of interest on the loan. It looks like the new law maybe accounted for that in some way to cap interest. I think it was to allow like at least $50 a month of progress towards loan payment. So curious if you could expand a little bit on those types of situations. Thanks so much.
Yeah, so the new law does reimpose the tax bomb. They view that as critical because they made forgiveness tax-free under the Biden administration, specifically because they wanted to do mass cancellation. So the tax bomb is sort of a casualty of Republicans wanting to block any future Democratic administration that does not have unified control of Congress and the White House from doing any cancellation whatsoever, because if they did, it would result in massive tax bills for everybody. So they are intentionally reimposing the tax bomb to prevent them from doing any mass cancellation. That's the reason they're doing it. Now, in terms of the interest cap, they're basically doing what they're doing on the SAVE plan. So if your required payment is enough to cover the interest, the rest of the interest is subsidized. They do chip in like a $50 per month amount on the principal, but it's so small, like for a lot of people in our audience, I think it's kind of pretty irrelevant, honestly. They're trying to make everybody think that what you've got to do is pay down your loan. That's what they're trying to do, is convince everybody that, you know, the only thing to do with student loans is just to pay them off. That's it. Of course, we know the math does not support that for a lot of existing borrowers that have a very high debt to income ratios, but that's what they're trying to do, is make it a little bit easier for people to pay down their balance and, you know, to actually see the balance go down instead of having it spiral out of control and having it be 3 times as large. It seems like both parties at least agree on that that's a problem. So that's kind of an interesting development in that bill. Next question.
Hello, my name is Vernon. Mine is straightforward, but I'm looking for advice on what to do with my remaining 11 student loans awarded between 2011 and 2016. $24,000 subsidized, $45,000 unsubsidized, about $69,000. I am 60 years old. PSLF is not an option. Income recertification has been pushed out until July of 2026, but payments resume on 8/18 of 25 at an amount that is nearly 40% of my take-home pay. The income recertification is based on my wife and I filing taxes jointly, but for 2024, we filed married separate. I believe I will qualify for an income-driven payment plan. I'm on the SAVE plan sitting in limbo. Should I go ahead and switch to an income-driven payment plan prior to July 4th, 2025, which is 45 days before repayment begins, so I can get a lower payment? Should I use a different approach? Should I wait? I lean towards doing an income-based repayment plan by July 4th. Thank you.
So I'm just mentioning this because this gentleman said he's in his 60s, I believe. So, you know, if you're a Parent Plus borrower, we need to triple check when the bill passes to see what's in the final version. But the current bill that's being proposed would create essentially a time bomb for Parent Plus borrowers where you would have to be consolidated by July 2026 in some fashion. And if you are not, for Parent Plus borrowers, you would be completely screwed for all time in terms of being able to get on an affordable payment plan. You wouldn't even have the option, I believe, to even do the ICR plan. So for Parent Plus borrowers, if you consolidate before July 2026, you would be able to access the old IBR plan. So in some ways, that's kind of nice because like the double consolidation, it kind of stinks that they're not honoring pay and not new IBR for that. But at least all Parent Plus borrowers could pretty straightforwardly access the IBR plan, which is very attractive compared to the ICR plan. And it's way more attractive than having to just pay it back. So for Parent Plus borrowers, and I'm not saying this gentleman might not even be a Parent Plus borrower. I just thought I'd mention it because he mentioned he was in his 60s and a lot of people that are in their 60s might have Parent Plus, but they might have their own loans or they might have both. And so for this gentleman, you know, I think that yes, you need to file taxes separately if you can without causing too much pain in terms of your tax penalties that you get hit with. And then I think that you would want to get into the IBR plan and I think you'd want to do it ASAP. And, you know, I think you'd want to do it once you have a married filing separate return to show as proof of income. You know, if you're eligible for only the IBR plan, your payments might not be that low, but it won't be 40% of your income. And that's definitely not doable. So I think that that would be my suggestion is yes, get onto an IBR plan ASAP for this person at studentaid.gov/IDR. Let's take another question.
Hi, Travis. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for this podcast and all the information that you put out. It's really been invaluable for me on my student loan repayment journey. I am going for public service loan forgiveness. I have been stuck at 118 qualifying payments out of 120 since my last qualifying payment in May of 2024. I believe June and July of 2024, I was in a forbearance due to a change in the way that public service loan forgiveness was being handled over to student aid. And then I was stuck in SAVE forbearance for a long time. I applied to buy back the time and SAVE forbearance. I still have not heard back about that. I also applied to switch plans. I put in an IDR application to switch to IBR. That application was in a processing forbearance confirmed by Mohila, my servicer, from November 2024 to March 2025. So for 5 months worth of time, my IDR application, my account was in a processing forbearance because of my IDR application being processed. I have certified my employment. I'm still with a qualifying employer. I have certified my employment through April 2025, and they did not grant me any months towards PSL, any eligible months towards PSLF. So I did not get the 60 days worth of processing forbearance counted towards PSLF. Now, if I had gotten those 60 days processing forbearance counted towards PSLF, I would be at 120 and I would be done. I have called Mohila. I have called Student Aid. I also submitted a reconsideration request saying that I believe that my count is inaccurate due to not receiving time for the processing forbearance. At this point, I'm just curious, you know, your take on this. I'm curious what else I can do to get those 2 months of processing forbearance time counted. You know, at this point, I've been an entire year stuck 2 months shy of forgiveness. and I'm just trying anything and everything I can. So your advice would be greatly appreciated. Thanks again.
I'm sorry for this listener because it's so frustrating. I mean, so I would first submit an FSA complaint. So go to the FSA complaint center, just Google it and you'll find the link. Submit a complaint saying, hey, I have processing forbearance while I was being switched to the IBR plan and they haven't processed anything. They also have not submitted, given me any feedback on the PSLF buyback whatsoever. And I would wait 2 weeks. I would do that. And then I would go ahead and submit a constituent services request with your senator's office. Whatever senator is the most senior senator or the one who's most worried about their reelection, you pick. And I would just essentially say that the FSA department is, or student department of ed is not processing anything for you. And you've been waiting for a year and you've done everything that you possibly can. And they are just absolutely ignoring you. And that's unacceptable, which it is. So I think that I would just get a lot more aggressive when it comes to the FSA complaints and then constituent services requests, which you find that by just typing in your senator's name, finding get help with the federal agency, find wherever that thing is on their website, and then you'll submit a form request or a contact form request. They'll ask you for a privacy release. You sign that, and then you'll be able to ask for that office's help intervening with the Department of Ed or your servicer on your behalf. Let's take another question.
Hi, Travis. Thanks for taking my question. My question is in regard to PSLF buyback. I submitted my request back in November of 2024. It's been 6 months or so since I've heard anything. I've been calling quite a bit, no update, nothing of that nature. And I'm on the safe forbearance right now, and I have about 107 payments out of 120. I have over 120 eligible qualifying payments for PSLF. However, I'm trying to buy back around 13 to reach that 120 number, and I haven't heard anything from the education department regarding that request. I recently called them to inquire once again about what's the status of my PSLF since it's been past the 90 days, and they told me that since I'm in the safe forbearance, like many of us are, they can't calculate my payment that I would have paid under a safe forbearance buyback period. Some of the months I'm trying to buy back are under the safe forbearance, and so they need an, I guess, IBR rated payment. I'm not really sure, but that's the way they explained it. They said I could go off the safe plan and apply for an IBR payment or get back into the IBR repayment system, and then go into general forbearance and wait for my PSLF buyback to come back and then pay that off and reach PSLF forgiveness. But I'm unsure about what to do, because if I do that, are they going to actually process it, or am I going to have to stay in the IBR repayment for the next 6 months to a year, assuming it's still available? I think my payments would be around $4,000 when they calculated it per month. And so my big question is, should I just stay in the safe forbearance right now and see what happens? And hopefully my PSLF buyback request will come through, or should I go ahead and switch over to IBR, go into general forbearance, and hopefully that will expedite my PSLF buyback request? Thank you.
And assuming you can make that payment, I think that I would go ahead and apply for IBR and get into a processing forbearance. At least it'd probably last a couple months. That would also buy you a couple more months to see if they would process that PSLF buyback request. And then I would do the same thing that I told the last listener. I would go and submit an FSA complaint saying, you know, hey, what gives? Why has it not been calculated, right? Because it's supposed to be the IBR payment before your forbearance or after with the lower of it. And they're saying they can't calculate it. That's just made up. It's because the Department of Ed is not doing their job. They're not giving them any guidance. And so the servicer just doesn't know what to do. They've probably gotten a wink, wink, nod, nod from the Department of Ed, basically to not do anything or to go super slow as they possibly can. I think that that's probably what's going on. So I would submit the FSA complaint. I would get constituent services involved, and I would go ahead and apply for IBR, get the calculated payment. Ultimately, if they're telling you that you got to pay $40,000 to be done, if you can afford it, I know that I would probably accept that. I mean, it depends on if you can afford it, right? But if you have 400,000 of loans or something like that, If you can pay $40K right now to be done with the uncertainty that's going on with this administration, I would take that trade, even though that's not really fair, but at least you'd be done. So let's listen to another question.
Hi, Travis. Thanks so much for the podcast and the YouTube channel. I really appreciate it. Just a quick question. I'm switching from SAVE to IBR. I just submitted my application for that yesterday. If I get denied for IBR because they take my spouse's income into consideration and our income together is too high, can I then go back, amend my tax return, change the filing status to married filing separately so that they only take my income into consideration, and then resubmit that application to switch into IBR? Thanks so much.
The answer is you can go back and apply again, but the catch is that you cannot amend from joint to separate. You can only amend from separate to joint. So in this case, you would have to have a married filing separate return, which if you did file your 2024 joint, that means you'd have to wait until you have a 2025 tax return, which you probably would not be able to file until February. That would be the problem in this case. I would just, if you do have to make a really high payment and you don't want to make that high payment, then I would try to get into a forbearance or maybe a graduated extended plan or whatever the lowest payment, including zero, is that you can get to not make those really high payments so that you can go and make really low payments based on a married filing separate tax return instead. So let's take another question.
Hello, I have a question about the future of student loan repayment calculations for Americans abroad. Right now, my monthly payment is based on my adjusted gross income, AGI, from my U.S. tax return. I live and work in the U.K. and use tax strategies like the foreign earned income exclusion or the foreign tax credit to lower my AGI when I file my U.S. taxes, which directly impacts my student loan payments. Do you foresee AGI continuing to be the basis for calculating monthly student loan payments for the foreseeable future, especially with all the changes in the government and all the bills that are being proposed? And is it still the right goal to try and get AGI as low as possible when filing taxes, or is there any real risk that the Department of Education or wherever these loans might end up might eventually switch to another method like using foreign gross income or some other measure for expats? Given my unique situation as a U.S. citizen in the U.K., is there anything else I should be considering or watching out for when planning my taxes and student loan repayment strategy? And just for more information, I have over $380,000 in federal student loans, so it's quite important to lower my monthly payments because I can't afford them otherwise. Thanks so much.
I actually have one of our financial planning clients that I spoke with about this. And, you know, one of the strategies that we have for her is to move abroad to a different country to take advantage of that foreign income exclusion to try to get her income, her AGI, as low as possible so that she will have very low payments so that she can get forgiveness. And also we're trying to find a place that's got the most similar weather to California in the Americas so that she can live in the same time zone, work remote, afford a really, really nice house, but like for a fraction of the cost of California and drastically lowering her student loan payments. So maybe some people listening to this podcast will be intrigued by that and be thinking about, you know, moving abroad after listening to this answer. But the great news is AGI will continue to be the method that student loan IDR payments are calculated on if the RAP plan passes. AGI specifically is called out as the metric that matters in terms of calculating the 10% of income. And it's 30 years for RAP. It's 25 years for all the old IBR plan. But yes, it will still continue to be AGI. The one positive that you can say for expats living abroad that have student loans is there are relatively few Americans living abroad compared to other countries. It's a lot more common to see Europeans living abroad or to see Australians living abroad or to see New Zealanders living abroad. But Americans, the vast majority of us just live in America. And that's kind of interesting. So this is something that Congress is basically overlooking and not thinking too much about because there's not that many people it applies to. So knock on wood, the existing bill stays as is and keeps our expat folks paying low payments. So we'll take a few more questions here.
Hi, I had a question regarding the buyback program. I will have an IDR payment of $1,055 a month, which for right now is not going to be able to fit my budget. The standard payment is $460 a month. When I do buyback for these ineligible months, will the buyback months be $1,055 a month? What the difference between the IDR and standard payment, which I will pay? The difference will be roughly about $600. Thank you for all you do.
So it should be the lower of the standard of the IBR payment. So I do believe it should be the $460 a month, but that is based off of an administration that has processed only 3% of all the existing buyback applications. So it's supposed to be the lower of the amount. Unfortunately, I cannot guarantee anything because of how unpredictable things are right now. But if you cannot afford the $1,000 a month, that is a payment that would be based on your income. I would think through if there's anything in a worst case scenario you can do to prepare for having to pay that if you absolutely had to. Is there anything that you could cut back? Are there any flexible expenses? Are there any things that you could defer in terms of expenses? That kind of thing, because you want to kind of put yourself into a situation where $1,000 a month would be doable in a worst case scenario. And if it's not, that's fine, but you'd want to at least probe a little bit into your finances to think through, is there any way that things could be temporarily cut back so that you could afford it in a worst case scenario? Because you wouldn't want to, for whatever reason, if they change the buyback rules with this bill, you know, be stuck not being able to get PSLF, even though you're kind of close. So let's take one last question.
Hi, Travis. Really enjoyed the emails and the podcast. I have a question about if I should recertify my income. I am currently on FMLA due to a major health issue. I am still working. I'm going through chemotherapy and I don't have short-term disability, unfortunately. So I am still working, but only about half of what I usually do. I am obviously making much less than what I normally do and was thinking that maybe I could recertify my income to try and get a lower payment because I recently switched to the IBR plan to try and get loan forgiveness for the PSLF route. Should I do that? Because when I submit my pay stub, it will show that the hours worked are less than 40 hours a week. So even though I am considered full-time and I have HR to sign off on, you know, saying that I'm a full-time employee, I wasn't sure if that would affect my eligibility by submitting a pay stub to try and get the lower payment if they see that, you know, if I'm not working the required 30 hours a week. Thanks for your help.
First off, let me say that I really hope that this listener wins their battle with their chemo that they're going through and, you know, that it's a quick and minor impact on their life and they get back to a healthy and happy life ASAP. That's just really frustrating to have to deal with something like student loans while you're also, you know, trying to fight for your life. It's just, and I will say this, there is something that people don't know about, a lot of people don't know about, called cancer treatment deferment. Cancer treatment deferment actually counts for PSLF, but you have to apply for it and that would give you $0 payments that would also count for PSLF. So to apply for that, you have to type out the cancer treatment deferment request form online. You can get it at the Student Aid website. So you would just, if you Google that cancer treatment deferment request form, if you Google that online, you should be able to get that and apply for that. And you should be able to get completely paused payments. You just have to have a physician sign off that you're going through the cancer treatment. And then you submit the completed form to your servicer and you get $0 payments, which is better than resubmitting for a lower payment. You know, that's zero instead of something. So hopefully that saves this person thousands of dollars knowing that they can do that. And again, I hope that you take the extra money and the stress reduction from having no student loan payments and use that to take care of yourself, go to massage therapy sessions, therapy sessions, watching your favorite movie, hanging out with your family, whatever you need to do to keep your spirits high as you go through chemo and try to win that battle. I've had a lot of friends that have gone through things like that and just really hope that this person has a great outcome. Thank you for all of your questions, listeners, for you listening. Thank you for listening to this. Having a lot of people call in and record voicemails kind of reinforces why I do this every week and why I've done it for the years, because I really do enjoy helping you, regardless of whether or not you can afford to pay us. StudentLoanPlanner.com/voicemail is the place to go if you'd like to ask your own question about future of student loans, about your own situation. We try to use this podcast to inform, sometimes entertain, but also to give back, knowing that, you know, some people are going to listen to this podcast and know that we know what we're talking about and they just want to get it over with and get a one-on-one plan and stop listening to the podcast. And some people, you know, who listen can't afford our services and we're able to give back in some capacity with the voicemail thing that we have for the pod. So again, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. If you want to record your own question, it's really easy. You just press a button on your phone and speak into it and that's it. And then if you need a plan, you know, go to studentloanplanner.com. And then I just want to say, I hope you have a wonderful week. I hope you're enjoying your summer. And until next time, this is Travis with the Student Loan Planner podcast. Thank you for listening. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.